Desire y'all's prayers this morning. That the Lord would give me the right words to speak. So what I wrote on the board is never in bondage. So I'm going to start off looking in John chapter 8. We're not going to read the whole chapter. But John chapter 8 starts off, Jesus comes into the temple, and he goes into the temple. He's going to teach the people. And as he's starting to teach, they bring him the woman caught in adultery. They bring her into the temple and they ask Jesus, you know, what should we do? And Jesus, he graciously handles that situation, both with the woman and her accusers, challenging the accusers to look to their spiritual cleanliness, and also showing grace to the woman, letting her know that he's not going to condemn her, but rather she should go and sin no more. And then he continues to try to teach the people. And his subject was that he was the light of the world. And if you were to read that chapter, you'll see the Pharisees did not, all of them didn't leave. Only the accusers apparently left. The Pharisees stayed and continued to question and challenge him regarding what he was teaching. But towards the end of what he was teaching, many of them believed, it said. And if we look there, starting in chapter 8, verse 30, it says, "And he spake these words, and many believed on him." And it says, "And then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him, If ye continue in my word, then ye are my disciples indeed. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Now here Jesus is trying to encourage those who's, right now it looks like, turning their hearts toward them. He's saying, you're hearing my words? That's a good thing. But if you want to truly become my disciples, if you want to truly be a disciple, was somebody who really adhered to what was taught, put it into practice, didn't just listen to it, somebody that really did it, he goes, you've got to really pay attention. But if you follow it, I'm going to give you knowledge of truth, and I'm going to set you free through that knowledge. And look how the people responded here in verse 33. They answered him, "We be Abraham's seed, and were never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, ye shall be made free?" Now, when we think about this response today, we have the Bible here. They had their history. They had the Judges and Chronicles. They knew the story of Abraham. They were claiming to be his seed. They knew that Abraham's seed had gone into Egypt. Had they gone into Egypt and stayed free, or had they come out of Egypt because they'd gone into bondage in Egypt? So it's one of those things that there's a question here. They're basically saying, we've never been in bondage. But there was Egypt, the time they spent there. If we remember reading in the Judges, I don't know how many of y'all have ever read the Judges as just, I'm going to call it as the historical story of the people. You're going to find in the Judges there were plenty of times they were under bondage to the different nations around them, the Philistines and different groups, and then a new judge would come up and get them out of their bondage, and then they would go for a while, then back into bondage. They were captive for 70 years in Babylon. And they weren't even able to stay in their own land during that time. They had to leave. And even at this time that they're asking the question, what do you mean we're in bondage? They were paying tribute to Rome. They were under the Roman law. And this is kind of what I want us to start thinking about. Why do you think they thought they weren't in bondage at the time under the Romans? What about that situation made them think they were free. It almost seems odd because we do know as Jesus was going around several times, they were like, well, we're going to make you king. And you're going to get us out from under the Romans. Well, the Romans had a policy called Pax Romana. It means peace of Rome. So when the Romans would conquer a country, they would make sure the people came under subject to the Roman laws and taxes. But they did it in a different way than what you might expect. They didn't just say, okay, here's all the Roman laws, y'all, your laws are done. What they said is, okay, you now are a part of Rome. We're going to allow you to continue your local laws and customs as long as they don't interfere with Roman law. We're going to allow you to continue your religion. Life for you will really not be any different than what it is before we took over. They would go around and they would take and they would set up client kings. They would go look at local people that were King Herod come to mind. He was a client king. And they would set this client king up. Pontius Pilate was the Roman governor over the area. Herod was a client king. He was technically under Pontius Pilate. But he was the local face that looked like the Israelites. They could say they had a king. But who was really in charge? Rome. They were very careful to try to give as much of an impression as possible that you're not really under bondage. Yes, you're paying us taxes and all that, and that can be burdensome, but look, you're getting a nice road system built. We're building public structures, amphitheaters. There's all kinds of good we're doing for you that yes, it's a burden to be taxed, but this is the benefit of being under Roman jurisdiction. Now, if people started breaking the law, if it was just the local customs or local religious issues that were being questioned, the Romans didn't even involve themselves with that. The Romans would say, well, in this case of Herod, this is your area, you're the client king, this is a local custom issue, you handle it. This is your responsibility. And then the only time the Romans would generally interject themselves into the affairs of the people was when it was truly something that crossed the Roman law. Now, doesn't that sound like a good tactic for the devil to use with people? If I can convince people that they're not really under bondage, if I can give them freedoms to a point, let them know they can still follow the Lord, they can still do all this, there's just this little tribute that I'm going to ask you to pay me. And there's some things I'm going to kind of want you to keep in your life, the things I don't want you to really get rid of. How many people would potentially find, you know, it's not really that bad. I can do most of what I want to. You know, there's some things that are put upon me, but it's not too burdensome. I can get used to this. Can we fall for that from the devil? And what I find interesting is Jesus was saying this to new converts, people that were turning their heart towards him. And if we look there in verse 34, Jesus' response to them asking about why did he say they were going to be made free when they weren't in bondage, Jesus answered them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin. And the servant abideth not in the house forever, but the Son abideth forever. If the Son therefore shall make you free, ye shall be free indeed." Now think about this back to the Pax Romana. Whoever's commits sin is the servant of sin, and the servant abideth not in the house forever. So if they were under Roman law, and therefore servants to the Romans, they weren't considered free people. They weren't true Roman citizens. That required you to either be born a free man or to have paid a great sum of money or some other way to attain that citizenship. They were subjects to Rome. They weren't free. But they weren't able to see it. They had listened to Jesus talking about being the light of the world. They had just watched what had went down, the grace that he had shown to the woman. And it had stirred their hearts. But then he said, I'll set you free indeed. You just have to follow what I ask you to do. And they was like, wait a minute. We're free. What do you mean? And one of the things that struck me is what did they base their freedom on? Actual circumstances? They based their freedom on Abraham. We are of the seed of Abraham. What do we base our freedom on? That we go to church, the church of God? That our parents went to the church for years? Our family has been in good standing with the church for years? You know, the devil's happy to have families in good standing with the church. But when it comes down to, are you free? You have to go back to what Jesus said. If you continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Too many times I think we get to looking at the world and we think, well, I'm not doing this other stuff. I'm not literally in chains, in the case of the Jews under the Roman law. I'm not being forced to hard labor. That's reserved for prisoners and true servants. I can still do what I want to do. Everything looks good on the surface. But let's look in Galatians 5. Galatians 5, starting in verse 19. Galatians 5:19. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of the which I tell you before, as I have also told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Now this is the things that we should be abstaining from, and it would be hard-pressed for us to look at this list and think, you can do any one of these things and still profess to be a Christian. But I would like to take a look at a few of these a little more closely at what I feel like are some tricks the devil will put out there. So, uncleanness. The word there is akarsia. And we're looking through the definitions, there was one that said an impure motive. And I got to thinking, you know, sometimes the devil, when he puts things out there, he'll say, you can keep your personal motives. You don't have to submit everything down to Christ. You can, it's all right to have personal goals and desires. It is all right. But what does the Bible say about a man that plans to go and travel to a certain city and do business? To buy and sell and get gain? Does it say he's just to say, I'm going to do that? Or instead, does the Bible say you should say, if the Lord is willing, I'm going to go do that? We have a certain amount of stuff if we'll realize the restrictions of what God has on it. But I want us to consider something. We're not going to turn to it. I'm just going to read it. But in Philippians chapter 1, verse 15, it says, some indeed preach Christ, even of envy and strife, and some also of goodwill. The one preached Christ of contention, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my bonds. But the other of love, knowing that I am set for the defense of the gospel. What then? Notwithstanding, every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached, and I therein do rejoice, yea, and will rejoice. And what struck me here is Paul is mentioning that not everyone who is in the church and preaching, looking at myself here, is doing so from a pure motive. Not from a pure motive. Some were doing it in an attempt to make it more difficult for Paul in his bondage. We know what Jesus had to say about those people, where he basically said, many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? In thy name cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works. And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. And I would challenge us. We think we're free, but what motives are you laboring under? Are you laboring under the true motives from Christ, following his word? Or are you still in bondage, just a little bit? Another person that had impure motives, Simon the sorcerer. He was a man. He put out that he was some great person because he could do, I'm going to call it, magic tricks. And he had done it for a while in this town. And the folks had put much stock in him. They actually referred to him as the great power of God. That's the way they looked at him. Well, he got saved, got converted. And he's following the disciples around. And it said in Acts 8 and 13, then Simon himself believed also. And when he was baptized, he continued with Philip, and wondered, beholding the miracles and signs which were done. So here he is, he's looking at him, and he's like, wow, I used to do some really neat magic tricks, but these are beyond any magic tricks I could ever pull off. And his brain starts working. And then he eventually gets around to asking a question. Hey, how much will it cost me to learn to do that? Now, it strikes me that by that very question, he admitted that his sorcery was fake. It was a trick. It was something that could be learned. You just had to pay the right man the right amount of money. And so he's sitting there, no doubt following the disciples around, looking at the wonderful things, but not looking at it from the motive of, wow, look at the power of God. His brain is looking at it from the motive of, if I can ever figure this out, I can impress people just like I used to do. I won't really have to give anything up. I can make myself an even bigger name. What are the motives that are driving us, keeping us into bondage? Another word that I would like for us to look at is emulations. Now, the Greek word is zelos. And normally, in this particular instance, it's normally used to refer to the fierceness of indignation, or punitive zeal. But when I was reading the definitions on it, zelos actually has a positive and a negative definition. In the positive side, where it's used positively, it refers to a state or being that causes other people to desire to be like that, to desire to measure up. And if you think about that, emulating someone would be, and I'm just going to use Brother Bobby's example. If Brother Bobby was cutting down a tree, and I said, wow, the way he did that's really, he's really skilled at that. I want to learn to cut a tree like Brother Bobby. I could go to him, let me watch what you're doing. What kind of tools do you use? I could start learning to emulate what he did. Emulations. Now, emulation comes from imitation. And there's two ways you can imitate something. You can either copy it, or you can simulate it. Now, when you copy something, you make an exact duplicate. If I wanted to make a copy of this bench, I could find the right kind of wood, cut it just the right length, do all the right shaping, glue it together, and when I'm done, I have an exact copy of the bench. You could replace it. They're 100% identical. No, no questions asked, that bench would replace it. It is an exact copy. A simulation, on the other hand, means that it appears the same. In our world today, there's computer games. And in the computer games, there's the simulated world that people run around in. There's some games, I think one was called Minecraft, you go around and supposedly dig and build stuff, and it's all in a simulated environment. But it's not real. A simulation will never replace or be able to be substituted for the real thing. So thinking about emulation in that sense, if I said I was going to copy good behavior versus simulate good behavior, is there a difference? Thinking back to my childhood, if I actually clean my room versus stuff everything in the closet, is there a difference? From the time mom pokes her head in the door and just glances around, everything looks really good. If I put it in the closet, I have simulated a clean room. I've got it looking, as long as you don't open the closet door, looking good. What happens if you open that closet door? Well, it depends upon how high I stacked it. You might have something fall on you. It may just be a pile of dirty clothes. You're like, well, why didn't you put these in the dirty clothes? Emulation. Sometimes we take shortcuts. And instead of truly copying the behavior we should, we start focusing on, you know what, I'm in a hurry. Speaking for the little boy's view, cleaning his room, I'm in a hurry. Why? I want to get back outside and play. There's important things I need to go take care of. You know, I've got a half dug hole with my Tonka toy. I need to go finish digging it. This room stuff is getting in the way. So how can I get it to appear clean as quick as possible so I can go back to what I want to do? So I do that. I put everything in the closet. Mom sticks her head in. She's happy momentarily. And I go outside and I start playing. And this has happened sometimes a few minutes later. Suddenly, hey, you need to come back in the room. It's not clean. You know, there's the dirty clothes here. Maybe it's not dirty clothes. Maybe it's just clean clothes that rather than fold and put away, just shoved in a pile. One of the things that I got to thinking about, and I'd mentioned in a message a while back, the wise and foolish virgins. You know, they were all the same. They looked identical. But there was one difference. They all had lamps. They all were lit. They all were doing the right things, going to the right places. But the ones that were emulating, that weren't wise, the foolish ones, they did not carry extra oil. Now, do you think they saw the extra oil? I think they did. And I have no doubt some of them may have asked, what's in the other bottle? What are you carrying around? And the others probably said, well, that's just extra oil in case we run out. Human supposition here. I think what happened to the ones that were foolish is instead of thinking, maybe I need to get some extra oil. These people are living, maybe I need that extra oil available. Or did they instead say, oh, that's a good idea. I'm glad you got the extra oil. That'll come in handy if we run out. At that point, they're no longer emulating the good behavior. They're now simulating the good behavior because, well, I don't really need to do that because you've got it covered for us. I'm going to step back and I'll still be here with you. And if my light runs out, I'm going to look to you for some of that oil. Another part on emulations that we run into, talking about the punitive zeal and indignation, sometimes we fall into bondage because we get to looking at other people. And not from the how do we help save them, but have you ever noticed the faults of so-and-so? We have the parable of the beam and the mote. What is that parable talking about? Is it saying you can't try to help your brother out with an issue he's having a problem of? No. It actually says you can. But if you've got a beam in your own eye, what are you supposed to take care of first? Don't be worried about your brother as much as you ought to. I mention that because at the beginning of chapter 8, what happened to the adulterous woman and her accusers? Did Jesus deny them the right to appeal to the law for her death? He did not. What Jesus did do was say, okay, you men that want to help this woman out and hold her accountable to the law, look to your hearts, and he who is without sin, throw that first stone. Go right ahead. Do you notice they weren't free to do it? They weren't free. They felt free. They felt lined up. They felt saved. In our terms today, I don't know if they would use that term back then. But they weren't free. Because when Christ said, okay, the first one of you without sin, go ahead and throw the stone. They couldn't do it. They had to walk away. Now there's another word I found interesting, strife. Aretheia. The actual definition comes from canvassing for public office or scheming. And I found that interesting. Canvassing for public office or scheming. Now, I don't know how many people in the last few weeks have received phone calls or texts or emails or even, you know, flyers mailed to your house, vote for me, vote for this person. We don't have it as much out here, but when we lived in Denham, sometimes you'd actually get candidates walking up and knocking on doors. Those folks were canvassing to promote a point of view. They were scheming on how they could get into office, if you want to put it that way. What kind of messages in our world today come with the political realm? Are they positive messages? Or are they more negative in nature? And thinking about scheming, just in life, how many of y'all have ever heard the term office politics? And what comes to mind when you hear the term office politics? Is it something like, oh yeah, that's good. That really helps out. I would love to work at a place with office politics. Or do most of us think, yeah, let's not have that, please? Why? The scheming, the lack of openness, the lack of transparency. You know, sometimes we get to looking out for our own interest. Is there anything wrong with that? It's a balancing act, people. This is, if you look at what the Romans did, they didn't throw out all of the local laws and customs, but they did say, we're going to keep just enough control on you so that you think you're free. But we're going to make sure you're tied in here to us so that we can keep you under the control we need. Thinking back to office politics and some of the situations I've had to deal with, I've actually had employees tell me that they were just trying to protect others with what they were doing. They weren't protecting anybody. They were causing a mess. But in their mind, they honestly felt like what I'm doing, trying, you know, not to share too many details per se, but a situation where something had been happening and it had irritated one person, so they go and tell the next person and then tell somebody else and tell somebody else. In a situation that would only two people would have known about if it had been handled correctly, that person spreads amongst 20 and makes an issue where there really wasn't any other than for the two people. Why? Well, I wanted them to know so that if this happened to them, they would know how to handle it. Well, how did you handle it? Did you confront the issue? Did you try to work through? No, I just went and told somebody else. Oh, so that's the way we're going to handle this. We're going to tailbear. We're not going to solve the issue. We're just going to spread the issue. That's not right. And the last word I want us to consider here, heresies. From the Greek word, heresis. To choose or select. Now, we tend to think of heresy as a religious issue. But I think this is probably one of the more subtle of the devil's ways of keeping us into bondage. Because heresies are choosing or selecting. Think of it like going to all-you-can-eat salad bar. Do you have to eat everything on the salad bar? No. The whole point of that type of establishment is you get to pick what you want to eat. You don't have to eat everything on it. You can pick and choose just the parts you need. In the Word Study Dictionary, one of the comments says, one can hold different views than the majority and remain in the same body, but he is a heretic. When he tears himself away, referring to the Greek word schizo, to split, rend, divide with violence, then he is schismatic. And I would just ask us to consider something. If we were to write up on the board, here's all the doctrines and teachings that the Church of God holds. How many of those teachings would you put a question mark by? Would you say, well, I don't know. Not quite sure about that one. Have some questions here. Maybe have some concerns. Maybe think we're not holding it tight enough. Do we pick and choose what we believe? You know, there's a difference between I don't understand something. There's a difference between honestly not understanding something versus I don't understand it and I don't want to deal with it. So I'm going to choose. I say that because sometimes we can make choices because we've got our freedom. The freedom the devil wants us to think we have. Because he says, you can choose. It's not in violation of Roman law what you're choosing. That's just a local custom thing that you guys have. But the overarching Roman law, the real thing you need to be careful of, you can choose. You don't necessarily have to do it that way. And if you run afoul, it's just your local king, local leadership. That's the only people you'll be in violation of. You won't be in violation of the Roman law. And as I mentioned, we can also be overly strict, overly zealous. Didn't it say about the Pharisees that they bound burdens on people that they themselves were not able to bear? That's a bondage. Oh, I'm free though. I'm free to say this is the line and you need to follow it. I'm free. Now you're not because I'm trying to put bondage on you. But we need to be careful with some of the tricks of the devil to where he'll be having us sit there and trying to tell us that you're free. You're free. You're free to make this choice. You're free to follow your own motives. You don't have to explain yourself to anybody. And there is some things that we can keep to ourselves, but when it comes to standing before the Lord, which is where my thoughts are today, do you have that freedom to tell the Lord that he can't look in your heart? He can't look for your motives? 1 Corinthians 8 and 9 says, but take heed lest by any means this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to them that are weak. Sometimes if we're not careful, our liberty can become a stumbling block. Our desire to choose what we want to choose, just only pick and choose the portions that we want to handle, our emulations, our simulations, our scheming, these things are subtle things. They're not things that you would see necessarily obviously. And these are not things that I'm saying we should be looking out into the congregation to see. These are things we need to look in our hearts for. This is not intended to be, go check your brother out. That's back to the beam and the moat. This is, and for myself as well, I'm standing up here, but I read about ministers that stood in the pulpit and preached out of contention, preached incorrectly. We need to be very careful that we, thinking we're free, are still under bondage to Satan, and we don't even know it because he's being so careful not to show us the hold he truly has over us. Let's focus on Christ and his advice to the folks. What did he say up there? He said, "If ye continue in my word, then are ye my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." The only thing that will really free us is looking to and following the word of the Lord. Y'all pray for me.